across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! Hello everyone, it's a mixed show today, from Irish language street signs to Royal Mail and how punctual the delivery service is, to house prices and the stamp duty changes that are coming up, to BBC and how it should be paid for, all coming up on The Nolan Show today. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. So this month, earlier this month, the DUP tried to block local residents from being able to vote on Irish language street signs across 10 streets in Belfast. They failed. Sinn Féin, the SDLP and Alliance won the day. They want the public to be able to vote on streets, the Armour Road, Delhi Street, Whitewell Road, Victoria Road, Upper Dunmurry Lane, Burma Street, Upper Newtownards Road, Sunningdale Gardens, Belmont Avenue. But have we got to the stage in Northern Ireland where it doesn't actually matter to local communities here, where it doesn't cause a hullabaloo? Or are the DUP right that there is real potential for adverse impacts, that there's real potential for community tension and worse? The DP, Sarah Bunting, Councillor Bunting, is with us this morning. Good morning, Sarah.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Do people actually care anymore?
I think they do. I think there is a view that these signs will be put up regardless of what people in the street actually want. So, you know, a 15% minority in the street, you know, 15% say, yes, we want the signs, and the other 85% say, no, we don't. You know, people think that is extremely undemocratic. So there is people out there who are really concerned about what is happening in City Hall with this.
And where do you think there is evidence that people, Sarah, actually, they may care, but we all care about a lot and then we get busy. Like, there's no real tension over this, is there?
I think there is, and we have seen that whenever street signs have went up in areas where it has been... you know, either areas where signs have, the residents have said they don't want the signs more than they have said they wanted them, or where it's been extremely close. There was one area in, or one street in my own area, where it was 50-50 because there was only two houses in the street. And it does, it causes a sense of tension between neighbours, and these are generally very settled communities. And it is causing people to look at their neighbours and think, you know, who's voting for this, who's not voting for this. So I have a lot of contact from people, and a lot of people who perhaps wouldn't necessarily be DUP voters normally, but they contact me because they can see that we are the only ones speaking out at committee about this.
Where's the most tension? Which streets?
Well, so far it has been quite a lot in South Belfast, because that is those sort of mixed areas off the Malone Road, those sorts of streets that the tension has come up so far. But we're starting to move in now. The street signs that were put through on last Tuesday night is mostly in East Belfast. I think that will cause great division.
Whereabouts, so, Sarah?
So on Tuesday night, it was decided to survey streets such as the Upper Newtownards Road, Belmont Avenue, you know, right in the heart of East Belfast, which, you know, they are a very much a unionist British identity area. It is causing concern that just one person in that street, a street the length of the Upper Newtownards Road, just one person who is on the electoral register can ask for this process to start with consultations, you know, and this is causing issues. People are raising the cost of the signs. I think if you look at the amount of money that was spent last year, we're looking at almost £1,000 per sign going up. You know, there's a whole lot of things going on. There's the cultural aspect of it, the democratic aspect of it, and the financial cost of it.
But isn't that the point, that if you take the likes of the Upper Newtownards Road area that you referred to, Sarah, it is a mixed area. And even if it's not, you're working with your partners in government now. You're working with Sinn Féin, Michelle O'Neill and Emma Little-Pengelly. Some people see it as a double act. They go places together. They work together. Why can't we all live together and share language together?
Well, I mean, we're not saying we shouldn't share language, you know, we certainly respect Irish language and the right of people to speak and learn it, but it doesn't mean that it should be imposed where it's not part of the community's identity. And this is about ensuring that East Belfast character as it is, and ensuring people feel comfortable in their own areas. One of those streets in East Belfast, which was decided on Tuesday night to be erected, even though it had been put to the back of the queue previously, was Winchurch Avenue in the Lithnashire area. It has been out for consultation twice now. So the first time it went out, 17.7% of people said they were in favour of the signs and 26.55% were against it. When we went out to resurvey the second time, it was 15.06% said that they were in favour of it, and it was up to 28.7% said they didn't want it. So actually more people had turned to not wanting the street signs, because we were getting feedback such as, what is the point in asking us these questions? You're just going to keep coming back and asking again until the majority of the council gets the answer they want, even though it's not what the majority of the street wants.
And what your party is doing, the story here this morning, is the DUP is trying to stop the vote from happening in the first place. What's democratic about that?
Well, I think it's the fact they're trying to get it stopped is that the policy is not democratic. You know, and at the end of the day, it actually all comes down to a political vote. And you're pointing out about working with Sinn Féin in the Assembly, but certainly if we made the decision in the Assembly that, you know, 15% would make decisions in Stormont, 85% against, I think there would be a bit of pushback there from the other parties. So, you know, I think the issue with going out is that it can raise community tensions where we do not need to be raising them.
Mick Fieldy, listening to this morning, the editor of Sligo Tool. What do you think, Mick? Good morning.
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm a fan of the Irish language. It's been in my family for many generations, and I would have been the first generation in my family not to speak it natively. My father didn't speak anything other than Irish until he was about five and went to school. So for a lot of us, the Irish language is part of the landscape. And if you look, I mean, even in parts of East and South Belfast where you wouldn't normally associate, you know, the people in the areas with the language, many of the street names are easily converted from English into Irish. And I think I certainly applaud the idea that there is local community control and the option and the opportunity for people to have it displayed. And I think aesthetically, some of the signs that I've seen, certainly around West Belfast, I think there's definitely a problem there. Personally, in that respect, as an Irish speaker, I don't see it as a waste of money. I think it's an affirmation of culture. But I am slightly disturbed by the fact that you only need one person to raise the question in areas where it's clearly not aligned with the popular view. And even in a situation there where there have been two votes, and each time the vote happens, the disfavour increases. It's not good for the language, you know. And the truth is, some really good pioneering work has been done by Linda Irvine with the Tourist Project. There's a great little nursery school in just off Montgomery Road called Scoil na Sealta, which is basically an integrated Irish language school. And there's huge, fantastically popular, you know, positive and popular work being done to demonstrate to people that it can be part of it. It's certainly part of your inheritance, whether you're Catholic, Protestant or dissenter, and it can be something you can be proud of. And I think this change in the rules, I think, is a little bit underhanded, and I don't think it does the cause of the Irish language any good.
What change, Mick?
With the change, it used to be that you needed 33% of the population in East Street to ask for the for the name to be in two languages, and now it only takes one or two people, who may be, you know, someone like myself who comes from a minority community in the town that I grew up in that is passionate about the language. But just having that low bar, I think, means that it can be triggered absolutely anywhere. And previously, there's been some sophisticated solutions. So Like, you take a road like Donegal Road, which, for the most part, from Shaftesbury Square up to Broadway, it's firmly loyalist, and you know, we know that in single identity areas that it would be very unpopular.
Yeah. Well, that part has been exempted, hasn't it?
The upper part that goes from Broadway up to the Falls Road, that's all firmly in sort of bilingual signage. So, and it makes sense where those communities want to see the language that is popular amongst their community reflected in the place names. But I think once you start going down this route of lowering the bar so far, you are creating unnecessary tensions. I would far rather see the language popularized in the way that the tourist project is doing it, rather than have it forced on people who basically don't see the relevance.
Sarah? Hello, Sarah.
Hello, sorry.
Do you want to respond to that, Sarah?
I think, you know, the language should be available if people want it. And certainly there is great work being done with Linda Irvine. But I think this language is being damaged for political gain. You know, this is being pushed into areas and 85% against something, 15% in favour, and the 15% get their way as a corruption of democracy, and it damages those democratic politics, and it makes people angry. It makes people wary of, you know, decisions that are taken in City Hall. It makes people wary of City Council as a whole then, and it makes people wary of elected representatives.
Here's Bran in Belfast. Morning, Bran. What do you think? Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. There's that word political used again as an excuse. My two grandchildren go to Irish medium schools from the very outset. They love it. They didn't go because it was a political reason. They went to learn Irish. But my main point, Stephen, is why do they dislike certain unionists, dislike the idea of the Irish language sense? What harm is it doing? Look in Wales. Wales embraces their language. Dual signs all around the place in Wales. So what harm is it doing? I mean, I can't understand that they're thinking, to be honest with you.
Well, Sarah, can you explain to Bran what harm it's doing? Why you're objecting to them?
Well, I mean, it's not that it's doing harm. It's doing harm in the sense of people are feeling that, you know, the politics that the
you're wrong. That's
made
wrong.
Are against, you know, democracy. I mean, if this was a truly neutral policy, it would require clear majority support and not just 15%. People feel a strong connection to the identity of their area, and introducing Irish language signage in a place where there's little demand sends a political message rather than a practical one. And we have seen in other areas that language policies can be divisive. It's not just about the sign, it's about what it represents in the broader cultural and political context. And those other areas of the UK, where there's dual language signs, such as Scotland and Wales, it's not a divisive thing there. We have a very complex history in Belfast, and I think we need to make those decisions, or, you know, based on the past, and we shouldn't be living in the past, but we do have to keep it in mind whenever we're making those decisions.
Michael Collins from People Before Profit. Councillor Collins, good morning.
Hello, Stephen.
Good morning. Sarah's making the argument here this morning. What's democratic about 15% of someone in a community in a street being able to dictate to the 85%?
Well, I think she's being a little bit facetious, because the reason why it's 15% is based on best international practice, and it's about respecting the rights of minority languages. So that's the key point, is that the rights of minority languages. If there's a minority, a significant minority of people in a country that speak a language, then that has to be respected. And the Irish language is not only a minority, but it's a very significant minority language. Not only that, but it's one that's historically suffered years of neglect, of underinvestment, and discrimination, frankly. And the DUP have intentionally scaremongered time and time again, attempted to whip up hysteria and fear when there is absolutely nothing to fear about the Irish language or about language or street signage in general. And I think that they're really trying to make a mountain of a molehill. And the reason why it's 15% is because that is best international practice, to respect the rights of minority languages. And that's practiced in countries like Wales, countries right across Europe.
What about the rights of the majority who might feel that they don't want this?
But the majority rights are well respected and well visualised in public signage and in every other aspect of society. This is if we're a democratic society that has to respect the rights of minorities, and that's what this is about. And there's significant minority groups that are coming forward and that want to see the Irish language displayed. They can't, for example, not only in street signs, but can't access services in Irish, can't do their forms for benefits for the housing executives in Irish, can't give proper funding for Irish medium schools and everything else. And remember, that it's the same DUP that we're cutting leaflet bursaries, etc., are telling us now that there's something to fear about the Irish language.
So do you believe, Michael, there should be...
the DUP, and the fish rots from the head on this. There is no widespread hysteria.
Do you believe, Michael, there should be dual language signs in every street in Northern Ireland?
No. If it's clear, I mean, I am for the Irish language being as visual as possible. And the 15% is in line with best international practice to protect minority rights. But if there's obviously if there's a street and the entire street gets back on a survey and says we don't want this here, whatever else, it's at the discretion of council ultimately to make decisions like that. And we have saw decisions where some discretion will be seen. Like in Donegal Road, we'll get half the street has an Irish language signage, the other half doesn't. But generally, I think that there has been a historic neglect of the Irish language. And that has to be rectified, and we've been far too slow to do that. And a lot of the pushback is coming from the top. It's been politically motivated by unionism, by the DUP, to try to whip up hysteria. And I would just call for proper leadership from unionist politicians, because the fish rots in the head. They set this kind of narrative, and they have a big, big responsibility to stop whipping up sectarianism around something as simple as a language. It's a thousand-year-old tradition, thousands of years, rich culture. All the place names in this place derived from Irish. So it's really, really foolish to try to cast aside that history for your own narrow political gains.
I mean, let Sarah respond to you.
Well, I mean, Michael says it's politically motivated, but the consultation before this policy was set showed that the majority of people in this city did not want a 15% minimum. And if this is really about inclusivity and respect for Irish speakers, it should mean respecting the identity and heritage of the local community. Forcing through Irish language signs where it's not widely spoken or desired does not promote inclusivity. It risks alienating the majority who do not identify with it. And if this was genuinely about inclusivity, there'd be real engagement with the entire community rather than a small minority pushing for change that the vast majority have not asked for. And I think at a time whenever council resources are already stretched, spend the money on unnecessary signage that does not reflect the identity of the area is wasteful. And ratepayers want to see investment in essential services such as parks and pitches and, you know, keeping the streets clean, not politically motivated changes to street signs.
Here's Joe and Cullibacky. Good morning, Joe.
Morning, Steve. Steve, I'm a Methodist from Cullibacky. And why I'm ringing you, there was a great Bob Dylan song called The Times They Are A-Changing. Okay? So I listened every Sunday morning to the service on Radio Ulster. So yesterday morning we had a great service from East Belfast Methodist Mission. And what did they do? They sang a hymn in Irish.
Oh, do they?
They did yesterday morning on Radio Ulster.
Okay.
But I just think I was referred to that great song by Dylan, The Times They Are A-Changing. It might be appropriate for you in Belfast to think about the signs are about to change. The signs, they are a-changing. You know, do you get the gist of that?
And do you care?
See, in Cullibacky, I'm about the house, and I the only place I remember in Belfast, I used to go to the Oval to watch the Ballymead play on the Glens, and the only street I knew in Belfast was D Street. Now, what would that sound in Irish? I don't know, D-E-E. I mean, I'm not that good at spelling these big Irish words, and I mean they're that long. They're quite expensive to put up on the side of a building.
McFeely?
Yeah, look, I mean, Michael says we shouldn't have legislation in to make it compulsory, but at least if you did it on a comprehensive basis, you wouldn't have these little firefights that are going on all the time. You know, and look, I mean, your last caller there made a good point. when you see a name that is clearly in Irish, like Clonfert, or very often some of the newer places built in the 50s and 60s, right across the city, come from you know, towns and villages way out west and out in the south, where they've clearly got an Irish language root. The words are very long, and that means that when you put the signs up, it's like I was saying very earlier, it can be a little bit inelegant the way that it reads. I would personally like to see the political will move towards whereby it was comprehensive and you took it out of all of these little skirmishes. But I do think there is a legitimacy thing. Yeah, okay, Michael says 15% is an international standard, but we're not living... we're not living in a southern Italian village where they want to pay homage to a bunch of Cathars that lived in the village maybe 400 or 500 years old. That's all part of the heritage, and it's non-controversial, and you can see the Italian and the Occitan language underneath. That's fine. Everybody is cool with that, and that's not a problem. But we have to recognise that unfortunately, the Irish language, beautiful as it is, much as an absolute fan as I am of making it real for people, you know, in some places, I think just saying 15%, regardless of whether there are 30% against it, means that you can then put the signs up. I just think it's insensitive, and it's going about it the wrong way. As I say, the tourist project, Linda Irvine, have done sterling work over the last 10 years and begun to change the landscape and people's understanding that the language itself is not a political act, even though some of the more political, I come from Hollywood, which has one of the oldest, despite the fact that it's 80% Protestant Unionist, or at least it was back in the day, has one of the oldest branches of the Gaelic League. A former president of the Gaelic League used to be one of the primary school teachers in town. And in my growing up, the people that I met that were fluent in the language were of both religions, and they were drawn towards it because of the beauty of the language, because of the way it helps them connect to places that maybe they grew up in. And it's that love of the language that we want to really try and emphasize and draw people towards, rather than setting up these little section fights whereby people are feeling that somehow they've been hoodwinked or pushed into a decision that, you know, there was a clear decision amongst that street or that community against it. And I think we need to avoid that, not only from a cultural point of view, but from there's a clear perception, I think, amongst the wider population that Stormont and the Belfast City Council are pretending to listen, but actually turning a tin ear to any of the consultations they put out there and going ahead and doing whatever it was they wanted to do. It will backfire, and it won't...
Backfire in what way?
Well, just because it makes those of us who love the language seem like we're some kind of malign alien force, when actually we are part of the community, but we want to draw people in rather than push people away.
Is it not the case, Mick, that once they're up and they'll become the norm? That the biggest hurdle is them going up. And look, I'm not pushing for them, I'm not pushing against them, but is it not just reality? Once they're up, they become the norm.
Well, that's why, in a way, I would favour a more comprehensive order, you know, if we could get the political capital to back it. Because once something goes up there and it becomes more familiar to you on a daily basis, you pass it every day, it's no longer this kind of alien thing that somehow threatens You know, and you know, the Provisional IRA campaign didn't help us in any respect in this regard. You know, the idea that somehow the language was part of a political struggle that took so many legs. We have to try and move from that situation to the point where it's part of people's landscape, and that they can see, once you see the language up there and you see the original sort of anglicized version of it, it becomes part of your home and your sense of your home place, without necessarily interfering with you know, your own political values or your own political cultural sense that you belong to the United Kingdom rather than United Ireland of the future. And I think that's the thing, that's the value of the work that people like Linda Irvine, Ian Malcolm and various others previously associated with the Old Tuck Trust have been doing for many, many years, building bridges between the language and the communities in which that language exists.
Michael Collins?
It's just so disappointing, really, that we're back here talking about this again. And there's such controversy around this, when to me it's really much ado about nothing, and it's a mountain out of a molehill being made once again by the youth establishment.
Are you not going to listen to the people who say, when you have a democratic consultative vote, that they don't want it? What kind of message are you sending to those communities, many of which lie far away from your own home base? Are we just not going to listen when a community says we would rather not have it, rather than judge them for being something that we can't possibly know why they've said that?
Right. Well, you said, Mick, that it was insensitive, the 15%, and it's insensitive to push Irish language into people's spaces and everything else. What's insensitive?
Well, I didn't interrupt you, Mick.
What's insensitive?
The point is, he didn't say that.
2,000-year persecution of the Irish language, the penal laws, the outlaw of speaking Irish, the murder, the sectarianism that has went around, the eradication of thousands of years of tradition, that's being revived. And whether you like it or not, thousands and thousands of young people want to see this promoted. Thousands and thousands of people are speaking Irish. It needs to be recognised in our public signage and in our public services, and it's not being done. And that's
political sectarianism. I come from an Irish-speaking family, on my father's side at least. I'm very familiar with the history, and I'm very familiar with the culture and how it has been snuffed out. And I'm very familiar with those heroes, those cultural heroes of mine who set up the first Bunskull on Shaw's Road back in 1970. You know, those people started off a movement that, through their absolute rugged determination, started off with no state funding whatsoever, no help from the state, and they built built a whole momentum, so that they're now, rather than half a dozen Irish speakers who use it on a regular basis like it used to be in the Common Clue and Ard, there are now thousands of people who want to see this happen.
All right.
All I'm saying is, we can't do it in an undemocratic way and shove it down people's throats.
Okay, Michael, Mick, Sarah, thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. We'll come back to your calls on Irish language street signs in a moment or two. Before that, the Cabinet Office Minister, Pat McFadden, has told the BBC that the civil service will be reformed under radical plans set to be announced this week. He was talking to Laura Koonsberg on Sunday. He said that parts of the civil service would and can be smaller, and he is looking at how efficient civil servants are. Begs the question, how efficient are they here in Northern Ireland? And is the civil service in Northern Ireland too bloated? And what from the political think tank Pivotal with us today is Frank Shivers, the businessman. Good morning to you, Frank.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Anne. Well, look, we see what Musk is doing in America. My goodness, making the civil servants write to him on a weekly basis, telling them what they've achieved that week or they're gone. Now we have the Labour Party saying the civil service is too bloated. It begs the question about here, Anne.
Yeah, we should always be asking these questions, Stephen, because civil servants are being paid with the taxpayers' money, and all of us should be delivering in our jobs, performing well, doing what we're meant to do. So I think we need to continually ask those questions. First thing to say, of course, is what Pat McFadden says applies in England, Scotland and Wales. Northern Ireland civil service is separate, so it's up to ministers here and civil service leaders to advise them on any changes in the civil service. The big thing I would say, I think, here is the civil service does what the government wants it to do. So you've seen the civil service in England, and England's got the Wales, grow in recent years, even under a Conservative administration, because there was so much going on with Brexit. And it has also grown a lot because of increased use of border staff and prison officers who are classed as civil servants. So the civil service grows if the government expands the roles that it has to do. So that's really important to say in the first place. As for the civil service here, I think there are lots of issues that they need to address. They need to respond to the fact that the world is changing. So they need to have far more emphasis on science and technology, how we can use AI better in public services. They need to be much more commercially aware. We saw a lot of issues about lack of specific skills coming out in the RHI inquiry back in 2019, 2020. So there are big issues about the type of people as well as the number of people. There are also huge issues identified by the Audit Office back in a 2020 report about poor performance in the civil service not being properly addressed. They said they had significant concerns about the effectiveness of performance management. So we need to make sure that people who are within the civil service are being encouraged and helped and supported to improve their performance to be as good as they can be in their roles. So I think the civil service has a lot to do, things I just identified in that Audit Office report, things identified in the RHI report. I think they are doing some of those things, but it's a journey that they're on at the minute.
We need to be careful here, and do we not, that, you know, public servants, civil servants, that there's not some type of global witch hunt that you see what the American administration are doing. You now see Labour talking about how the civil service is bloated, and you start forgetting of the vital jobs that these people do, the hard work that they engage in. Like, it's too easy just to say it is bloated, get rid of lots of them.
Completely. Civil servants, on the most part, are delivering public services to people. So they're working in jobs and benefits offices, they're working in prisons, they're developing policy ideas and delivering policy ideas. So most civil servants are paid, actually, this is really interesting, I checked this yesterday, the median, so the average earnings for civil servants in Northern Ireland is £31,000. Northern Ireland median earnings is £34,000. So civil servants' average earnings below Northern Ireland average. So I think that's important to put out there. Most civil servants are on, well, you know, average or below average salaries. There are some civil servants on much bigger salaries, clearly. So grade 7 civil servant, which is kind of start of the senior management, £59,000. Grade 5, which is the couple of steps above that, £84,000 and upwards for senior civil servants. So there's big amounts going on there, but most civil servants are not paid huge amounts of money.
Frank Shivers?
I sort of agree there. What we've got to realise is we do need civil servants. We need them in our NHS. We need them right across the board. My problem is I think that we have too many sort of middle management type stuff that really aren't delivering. The people on the ground, absolutely, and probably need to be paid more. The people in that middle management, we need to eke it out and see who's productive, who's not productive, and that's what the Labour government seem to be wanting to do.
But how do you do that? How do you decide who's productive or not?
Well, in Northern Ireland, you look all around you, you just see the waste on it. You know, four or five...
Yeah, but you're talking about individuals
boards,
here.
Let me finish. It was four or five health boards for a population of 1.9 million people. I mean, just even just addressing that issue would save millions.
But if you start drilling down, Frank, and is that what you meant, to whether individual civil servants are productive or not?
I think we've got a number of issues across the board, both in the mainland and in Northern Ireland. You know, we've got a massive sickness. It seems to be a normal thing to have that increased sickness, whether that's the contract that they're trying to wangle. But we need to drill down. We need to get what we need for our money. That's what we need to do. We don't seem to be getting value for money in our civil service.
Says who?
Well, the Labour government are now saying it. But, I mean, let's be honest, we've been saying
it
for
ages. They're not talking about Northern Ireland, for a start. They're not.
Well, we're always talking about Northern Ireland, and Sue Gray was given, I think it was $700 million some time ago to reform the Northern Ireland civil service and failed miserably. Spent the money, indeed, but didn't really reform. You know, we tried to combine different councils. We had a number of years ago, it was 5 or 6 years ago, we were promised it would be less staffing, better efficiencies. And what we find is quite a number of them, we've actually got more staff and less efficiency. So something needs to be done. And this is public funding. This is taxpayers' money that's being wasted. So, you know, well done to the Labour government for looking at it.
So, Anne, there we go. There's Frank before there's been any. This nearly makes the point behind my question. There's Frank talking about a waste of money before any evaluation's been done, Anne.
Yeah, I think it's important to say civil servants, people who work in health trusts are not civil servants. People who work in councils are not civil servants. So the Northern Ireland Civil Service is about 23,000 people. So they're the people who work for the government department. How do you identify where is good performance and where it needs to be improved? It's about leadership, isn't it? It's about leadership from the very top of the civil servant, from the civil service, from the head of the civil service, from the permanent secretaries. It's about putting in place proper performance management that incentivizes people to perform really well, and that also that addresses poor performance. And this is not addressing poor performance is a long-standing issue across civil service here in Northern Ireland and elsewhere. So Northern Ireland Audit Office report in 2020 found, and this is really shocking, found that only 19 people in the civil service, in the whole of the civil service, 23,000 people, only 19 people's performance was judged to be unsatisfactory. And that must be wrong. You cannot tell me that there is not more unsatisfactory performance in the civil service. So we must use our performance management mechanism, structures, reporting properly and address poor performance. And that comes down to leadership. It comes down to proper policies.
Does it need an outside
line manager?
Does it need a Musk type, or at least an independent overview of what's happening? Can you trust the top of the civil service to look within?
I'm very sceptical about bringing in more consultants to do jobs which should be done by civil servants. So, you know, this has happened endlessly over the years. The civil service can't do something themselves, so they bring in extremely expensive consultants to do it for them. I'm not a fan of that. I think what we probably could do would be some use of some more independent oversight. So not expensive consultants who you're paying £1,000 a day to, but some, you know, non-exec types on civil service leadership board who will bring private sector experience, bring experience from, say, the voluntary sector, who incidentally deliver a huge amount on virtually no money in many different organisations in Northern Ireland, bring expertise from outside and challenge that at a board and a leadership level. But I'm not a big fan of bringing in more consultancy, because that is
I would agree, but
taxpayers' money.
Could I also comment, Stephen? I mean, they find they're 19% or below par. Can you imagine a private company accepting that?
It was 19 people. It was 19.
Oh, sorry,
people.
19 people. Sorry. I picked you up wrong. My apologies.
Okay.
But even 19 people out of how many? What? How many people is that?
Okay, Frank. Thank you, and thank you. Back to the Irish language street signs we were talking about at the top of the show this morning. Joseph is in Bangor. Morning, Joseph.
Hi there, Stephen. Good morning. I have a bit of a head cold, so please bear with me.
That's all right.
So it's all the sea air from Bangor. I was a bit taken aback there. The lady felt a sense of disquiet, personal disquiet. She felt that there might be some adverse impact in the community, unionist community, if there was some Gaelic street signs put up. I'm speaking here from Bangor, and where I live in Bangor, Ballyhome. I mean, the name Ballyhome is derived from Gaelic. You'd be familiar with Ballya a Clee for Dublin. Well, Ballyhome is a suburb of Bangor, the same route. Bangor is a Gaelic name with an ancient tradition. Go back. I sometimes go across to Glasgow to the football, and you see lots of Gaelic street signs around Glasgow. They're bilingual. If you look around, as I was across in Cardiff recently for the rugby, lots of Welsh signs around there. Our future king, the Prince of Wales, is learning the Welsh. That's a Celtic language, so why not? It's a bit of cultural diversity and reflects our diverse traditions. And speaking of diverse traditions...
So you could apply that to every street, couldn't you, in Northern Ireland? So are you advocating dual language signs everywhere throughout Northern Ireland?
I'm advocating democratic choice. I mean, that's basically what it's all about. If there's consent from the people, why not?
Well, how is there consent from the people if the threshold is 15%? If 15% of those in a street...
I'm sure our elected representatives can work that out. They're clever people. I will leave it to them. I'm sure you have them on your radio show every morning. And I'm sometimes struck too by the thought of one of them mentioned community tension in South Belfast off the Malone Road. I wonder too, could you put up some signs there, perhaps, seeing we have a more diverse community up there, perhaps some signs in Urdu or Hindi?
Joseph, thank you. Gavin, you're calling us from Southwest Wales this morning. Morning, Gavin.
Morning, Stephen. Don't think I've spoken to you before, but here we go. I just want to point out that over the years, I mean, I listen to you every morning.
From Wales?
Yes.
Okay.
Indeed.
Good man.
Now, over the years, I have heard many, many people come onto your show when they make comparisons between Northern Ireland and Wales. I'd love to know where some of them are getting their information. Now, this morning I've heard Brian from West Belfast. I've heard Michael Collins, who, if my memory serves me well, is he a councillor? Is that right?
Yes, People Before Profit.
People Before Profit, that's right. Now, all the point that I want to make is that anyone who comes on and talks about Wales from Northern Ireland has this rosy picture of this wonderful place where everybody goes about happy as Larry with Welsh. That is not the case. They're ignorant of it. I don't know where they're getting their information
from. So tell me what it's like.
It's quite divisive. A lot of people just cannot be bothered with it. Other people are ardent Welsh fans, and that's all there is to it. Makes no odds to me. We don't have... In the area down here in Southwest Wales, we don't have bilingual signs that I'm aware of. The only reason I say I'm not aware of is because I don't see them. I'm blind. So it doesn't really matter to me. But I do find a lot of people I speak to where you have road signs which are bilingual have a lot of complaints because the road signs being erected have now got Welsh as the first. They're at the top of the signs. And many have said to me, if you're travelling at 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, you don't always pick up what the actual thing is.
Okay.
Gavin, until it's too late.
Gavin, thank you. Oisin and Derry. Morning, Oisin.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. My goodness, you're all reacting to this today. This is what you want to talk about.
Can I speak now?
You can.
Yeah, I just want to pick you up on the fact that I think you're being disingenuous this morning because you keep referring to Irish language street names or nameplates going up, Irish language signage. There is no Irish language signage going up. It's dual language signage.
Yes, obviously it is.
Yeah, but why do you keep referring to it as Irish language signage?
Because the street signs, which are currently just in English, are going up with dual language, with Irish language on them. That's the story.
No. They are dual language signs.
Correct.
Not Irish language signs. So you shouldn't really be referring to them as Irish language signage. And that's where I think you're being disingenuous in this morning.
Okay. So you'd prefer if I said dual language signs?
Absolutely, because that's factually correct.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you, Oisin. Rosemary, good morning.
Oh, good morning, Stephen. Every time I hear this issue coming up, Stephen, I just, my blood boils. What country are we in? I know we're in Northern Ireland and all that, but in the whole, we're in Ireland. Our language is beautiful. I wish to heavens I had learned it when I was younger. The only one, by the way, Irish I have now is Cave Me the Falter, and even I don't know if I say that correctly. But anyway, as long as we have a lovely country, there's a lot of things wrong in our country, and at the moment, Stephen, you've highlighted them. I listen to you every morning. Some mornings I agree with you, other mornings I don't. But what it calls, you do highlight the Irish language, Stephen.
The reason we're doing this story this morning, by the way, Rosemary, and our last caller probably had a point. I should be sending dual language street signs, right?
Yeah.
He has a point.
I agree with him there.
He has a point. The DUP is trying to block. So the way it works is the public doesn't automatically get a vote. The council has to decide whether the public gets a vote or not. And the DUP is trying to say, look, there are some streets where it would just be too divisive. Let's not let it even get to the stage of a public vote. But
well, you know what I say, Stephen? I mean, if you don't want to live here, then go. If you don't want to accept this as Ireland, as part of our culture, it's in our everyday language. Broke shoes, Irish. You know, and I, as I said before, I would love to learn, but I'm too old, I'm too long in the tooth. And Stephen, I and a lot of people like me have a lot more things to think, worry us. As you've highlighted in your programme, health issues. And can I just say one thing?
And by the way, Rosemary, the council doesn't decide. It's one person in the street. That's the way it works. Can decide to have a vote or not. The DUP is trying to block certain streets from getting a
vote.
Well,
I know I am for democracy. I know, and fairness and life and all things. I don't know, Stephen. I'm just in Ireland. You go to France, for instance. You go to Spain, Spanish. You know, and their language. I mean, Stephen, I give up. Sometimes I give up in this country because there's so much more. I'll tell you what, Stephen, there's an issue this morning, maybe in the northwest here. I don't know if it affects the rest. Carers have, or my husband, they weren't told properly, but the way this new system was coming in today.
Well, we'll certainly have a look at it.
So there's
Rosemary,
one to look at.
Thank you very much. We will. And make sure you contact us with any stories you want us to cover. Margaret did just that about Royal Mail. She's explaining what's happening in her postcode area.
About 3 or 4 weeks ago, I'd been talking to my neighbour and we realised that our post had been very irregular. It hadn't been coming. In fact, it was probably 4, 5, 6 days of intervals before we received any post. And about a week or so later, I noticed every day, actually, almost every day, that the post van was in the street anyhow. And one day I happened to be out when the post van arrived and I asked the postman, what's happening with all the mail? It's very irregular. Some days, for quite a few days, it doesn't come and then suddenly we'd maybe have 5, 6, 7 letters all come at once. And I was always used almost to getting post every day.
Oh, dear. Are you? You see, I open my box about once a month.
Yeah.
Honestly,
well,
I do.
It must be a big box, Stephen. But he said that they were told that they had to give priority to parcels. And that's why he was in the street every day delivering parcels and just to deliver the mail whenever they could. And he said that they were very short-staffed and the ones that were down there didn't want to deliver mail.
What?
They
didn't want to deliver mail? What do you mean?
Uh-huh. Well, they just didn't want to do it. They didn't want to do the job. And, I mean, our regular men are absolutely fantastic. The guys that have been with us for years and years, you know, never had any problem, any bother. But he said this was the problem. They didn't have staff, and the staff that were down there didn't want to do it. So, I mean, I really was quite shocked when you consider that it's about 185 for a stamp now, a first class stamp.
Is that how much it is for a stamp?
It is. And I think it's about $260 for a large letter, first class. And when people are paying that, they expect their mail to be delivered the next day, you know, or the day after that, the very long. But that's the situation. So, but after actually had got in touch with you, I noticed that I had 2 deliveries with a day between them. So I don't know whether they've picked up on that or...
Aye, but after we've been in touch.
Yes,
Have they upped their game?
Hopefully, and we'll all start to get mail again.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because that service that we were used to getting years ago, just with email and how we communicate with each other, and the likes of the Amazon deliveries and the other deliveries that there is, they're competing against lots of different efficient ways with technology.
They are, and I totally get that. You know, there is big competition out there. People send emails rather than post, and it's a vicious circle because that has put the cost of the postage up. You know, and I could even understand that there's no second class delivery now. You know, it used to be, of course, years ago there was a first class or first delivery in the morning and then about lunchtime.
What do you mean there's no second class?
Sorry, not there's no second delivery.
Oh yes.
I understand that because of the way things have gone, but you know, I do expect a proper delivery service, a regular enough delivery service.
So am I hearing you right? Am I getting, because it's a bit early in the morning, it's after the weekend, Margaret, it takes me a bit of time to warm up, right? So am I getting this right? Are you saying that letters, that deliveries of parcels and all has become, you know, so
given
much
priority.
Now?
Yeah, obviously they're making more money out of that than what they are in delivering letters.
I see.
You know.
I see. Well, look, but because the likes of hospital appointments and all of that,
I know
that you get stuff, isn't it?
It's important that you get letters from hospital because so often, even when they're typed up, there's a few days before they're posted out.
Yeah.
So there's a few days often that lapse there before, you know, it's even in the postal system. And then if it's not being delivered for, you know, 5 or 6 days, then you could well have missed your appointment.
Well, let me see what Royal Mail have told us. They've said the mail continues to be delivered to the area throughout the week. However, due to vacancies and a higher than usual level of sickness absence, there have been some recent instances of delay. Any mail which is not delivered is prioritised the following day. We have plans in place to improve the service, including ongoing recruitment. Oh, so higher than usual level of sickness. Some recent instances of delay. They're not telling us how many. And clearly, you know, anecdotal, it's quite a lot.
Well, it is because, you know, it has been, and I noticed it even before talking to my neighbour, and he had noticed it as well, you know, maybe 4 or 5 days. You know, before you were getting any mail, and as I say, it was coming maybe, you know, 5-6 letters in a bunch. So I knew there was something wrong somewhere, you know, and that's the situation. But hopefully, maybe you getting in touch with them has helped to sort that out for us.
Okay, well, look, I'll tell you the benefit of bringing this to this programme, because we can start to get a feel now as other people listen to this, and they may be telling us about their postcode area and how long they're waiting on their mail. So that's really helpful, Margaret, and thanks very much for contacting us.
Okay, Stephen, thank
you. Here, you sound bright and breezy this morning.
I'm half dead. I'm an early riser.
What time do you get up in the morning?
I get up about 6.
Do you know when I know?
Always have done.
Do you know when I know when I will have made it? When the BBC hangs a microphone over my bed.
Okay.
on a wee stand. And I'm able to lie there and wake up, open my eyes and talk to you all from bed every morning.
Maybe that technology's for the future. What do you think?
This lot won't let me do it. I know they won't. All right. Thank
you. Well, there
you are.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Good morning, everyone. Let's look at stamp duty next, because in Northern Ireland, you'll pay more stamp duty after the 1st of April. Two key thresholds are being reduced. At the moment, you pay no stamp duty if you're buying a house worth less than 250 grand. In a few weeks' time, that is going to drop down to £125,000. John Minnis from John Minnis Estate Agents with us this morning. Morning, John.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So are you seeing people racing to beat that deadline?
Well, we have seen that, and certainly from the start of the year, we've noticed many more properties coming to the market, properties that may have waited until March or February or March to come on the early part of January, which created a lot of options out there for people, and especially the new people to the market in 2025. Normally we're holding people off, saying, oh, you know, there'll be more property coming to the market in February or March. But this year, the market's kicked off quite early because of the stamp duty and people trying to avoid that rise in stamp duty.
Is that healthy, though? Is that people maybe bidding up property? So, when you see people racing towards properties to save a couple of grand, I'm not diminishing how important that money is, but are they making the right decisions for a long term view?
Oh, I think so. I mean, people want to save money where they can save money. Sellers want to give purchase of their property they're selling the best opportunity, and one would suspect if we didn't have to pay as much stamp, we might get a little more for the properties, and I think that's why that has happened. But I do feel that momentum will run through April and May, and I don't think the stamp duty new threshold is significant enough to create a problem in the market.
And why do you think the momentum will be there this year again?
Because it has started early. We've sold plenty of property through January and February, and this market seems to be very resilient, and there seems to be a momentum out there at the moment.
Where are you seeing the most momentum? Which type of houses?
Probably the middle part of the market. The early and middle part of the market is where we see most activity. But that would be fairly natural. You know, if you think of the market as a pyramid, the higher up the market we go, the less people there are about to buy. Now, this is where the stamp duty changes may have more significance, and that is in the purchase of a second home, where there's an additional 2%. So at the minute, it's 3% on top to buy a second home, and come 1st of April, it'll be 5%. That might slow down the investor market, second homes market, holiday home market.
So that's these holiday homes up in Port Stewart and Port Roche, etc.?
Yes, we'll just have to see how that transpires. That would probably be, in my view, where there'd be most significance in this stamp duty change. But we shouldn't forget that the stamp duty isn't... in 2019, we were paying more stamp duty than what is proposed from the 1st of April.
And if we look at some of the statistics, the average house price in Northern Ireland, these were house prices... I'm reading from a BBC News article in February, last month, in other words.
Yeah.
And the headline was, average Northern Ireland house price reaches 17-year high. The average house price in Northern Ireland rose by 9% during 2024. Average house price in the final quarter of 23 was just over 168,000, rising to just over 183,000 by the final quarter of 2024. When you see those type of rises and the highest in 17 years for a house price, I'm just wondering, John, if there's a bubble going to burst.
Oh, I don't feel that is the situation we're in. I mean, we're back to where prices were in 2008, which means we aren't still at the high of 2007. But I mean, we've been a long time coming back from that crash in 2007.
Okay, John, thank you. Morning to you. Here's another John calling us about Royal Mail. Morning, John.
Hello.
Go ahead, sir.
Yes, I would listen with interest to this item coming up because for at least a year now, I have been having a problem with Royal Mail not delivering for up to 9 days after the bill. Each month, BT send me a bill on the 23rd of each month, and they say that we expect it to be paid by the 2nd of the following month. And often, I do not get the actual bill by the 2nd of the following month, and then I start getting reminders from and threatening to be cut off or your credit rating will be altered.
Oh, really? You get your mail really late then?
Very, very late. As I say, it can be 9 days, and I the bill doesn't actually arrive. I mean, I will take the bill along to a local spa shop and get it using the barcode. I will pay that way. I like that because I will have a receipt of the bill. As I say, it's extraordinary. I have raised the issue with BT. BT actually have an office in Coleraine. I raised it with them, and I raised it directly over the phone with BT. But nothing seems to have been passed on to Royal Mail, and no action is ever taken. And I'm just left with a problem. And I must say that I have to pay £3 a month for the privilege of having a printed bill sent out to me, but it seems it's just a waste of money. Because
what area? What postcode area are you in, John?
Yeah, BT513.
Where's that?
Yeah, BT. It's Coleraine.
Coleraine?
Yes.
Oh, all right. Well, look, let's see what others say around that area and around. This is why we want to do this story and see if there's a trend or a pattern of delay with mail. Maybe there won't be. We'll see. John, thank you. 030 30 80 55 55. Next, should the rich pay more to watch television? The BBC chairman, Samir Shah, brought up a sliding scale in his conversations so that poorer households might get a discount. It was a wide-ranging interview with the Sunday Times. He dismissed the idea of a subscription model, said BBC News needs to raise editorial standards to avoid the kinds of mistakes that led to the botched documentary about Gaza. He also claimed that Match of the Day should show less football. Gene Seaton is the official historian of the BBC and Professor of Media History at Westminster School of Media and Communication. Morning to you, Gene.
Hello. Hi.
Good morning. And Malachy O'Doherty, author and Belfast Telegraph columnist. Morning, Malachy.
Morning, Stephen. Morning, Gene.
So, Gene, this...
Hello, Malachy.
So, Gene...
How are you doing? You well?
You two
doing well.
You two clearly like each other. That's a good thing.
Full fan.
So, Gene, should the rich, as Samir Shah has introduced for conversation, be paying more to watch the BBC?
Yes, I think they should. And I think that other countries, Finland... I mean, these are tiny... tiny countries and their public service broadcasters are tiny, and they completely depend and worship the BBC and our more broader public service broadcasting system, but they have sliding scales, and I think that rich people will always have access to high quality, you know, let's put aside the problems at the moment. I'm prepared to come back to that. But high quality, verified information, rich people can always buy it for themselves. The important thing is that everybody shares really good quality information and indeed decent feelings and funny programmes, all of these things. So I think some kind of sliding scale. And myself, I would make businesses that put up the BBC, I'd make them pay a bit more. And I think in a time of difficulty around money, then I think it's only right that that should happen. So I think it's a very good idea. I think subscription is a terrible idea. It sounds plausible, but it means that rich people would get posh programmes, useful programmes, and poorer people would get less good programmes. And I think that's And it would destroy the BBC.
So would you support the licence fee being means tested and different bands for different income groups?
I think what I would do, but this is all to be, you know, the devil, as they always say, is always in details. I think I would support something like attaching it to household taxes or something like that. I mean, I think these things all need thinking through. We're not in a world, if I may say so, like America, in which somebody says something and then various lunacies have to be unpicked slowly afterwards. So I think that needs consideration. But I mean, I also think, actually, that we need to really think hard about attaching the license fee. Lots of young people say they don't watch television. We know that they use the BBC the whole time on their telephones, on their computers. I think we need to make the license fee something like the license fee, make everybody pay their due contribution. So I think that's the other thing that needs technically to be rolled out.
Maliki?
Well, it's very complicated, isn't it? I mean, I the problem is that you need to reach, as Jean says, the people who have least resources, who have most need, if you like, of being informed about the world through public service broadcasting. But these are also the people who are showing least interest in it. You know, you are getting this drift away from it, and you're getting a drift away from the idea that the BBC can be this kind of overarching authority that, you know, that is more dependable than anybody else. And so how do you persuade people who struggle to afford it that they do need this, that it is good for them, that public service broadcasting is about maintaining the quality of democracy? And we see in other countries what happens when basically the standard of public information is so low and so contentious that idiots can vote it into power, if you don't mind me saying so.
You're talking about America, and it's your opinion, but I got a pushback in you describing, you know, tens of millions of people as idiots.
Well, I do think that one of the problems that produces that throws up a leader like Trump must be the standard of political awareness or the degree of education within that electorate.
Let me just turn that round, because I think you can just think about it in a slightly different way,
we are
in a period of extraordinary change, and we are in a period of extraordinary potential conflict. And our information systems are vulnerable to every kind of attack by, you know, gangsters, but gangsters who are employed by or allowed by, you know, Russia, China, Iran. We wouldn't let... I mean, I think it's not... I think it is complicated, and, you know, young people are... We need to think much more... Sorry, young people are very vulnerable, as we know. There are these brave parents who are taking TikTok to court in America. These are all over showing programs that they believe led to, and they have some evidence, led to their children accidentally killing themselves because they were taking part in games. Now, so these are all related things. You cannot have anything like a democracy unless people have access to alternative points of view and they can learn to disagree, but in a civilized way. So without being rude about America, you can look at all of the evidence about what's happening to our information system. And yes, I think there was a big challenge to the BBC. But more Americans are watching the BBC than ever before because at least they feel that it's independent for them. So, you know, what do you do when you're an autocrat? I've just been to India. You attack the media. So
yeah.
Those are the people you take out first, actually. You know, the reporters who say house prices are going up. I just was listening to your wonderful programme and we had... Absolutely, the essence of local news. What's happening to, what does it mean to have stamp duty? What's happening to house prices? Postal delivery. You know, those are things that really matter to people. They need to be part of our daily diet of news.
I think the question this morning, though, is how, it's not whether the BBC should exist, Maliki. That conversation can happen, but it's a different one. This is about how should it be paid for. And what Mr. Shah, the BBC chairman, is introducing is the potential for those, for essentially those that can afford it, to pay more to subsidise those who can't afford to pay for it.
And for it to be free to those who can't afford it at all, you know. So, in my thinking, it tends towards being a levy on the income tax. You know, that's the way that it's done, because that's the system that's in place already. That's, if you like, graded between low income and high income. So if you attach it onto that in some way, but then you end up with the you've got it to agree as well. It's a national broadcaster, and if it's done through the tax system, then the impression is that basically it is a tool of government.
Yeah.
And yeah. the BBC have to retain some credibility as not being a tool of government.
Yeah. I would set up a sort of an independent body, but these words are meaningless unless they've got the right people on them, that sets the licence fee and perhaps appoints the chair. So I think there are some things that sound boring. But I think the key, you know, the BBC has lost nearly 37% of its income since 2010. I mean, people just need to understand it's been savagely attacked. You know, the interview in the Sunday Times was riveting because usually the Times and the Sunday Times, which are both actually very good newspapers, part of the Murdoch empire. Sky is wonderful. Its equivalent in America, Fox, I think, was prepared. They were prepared to say in court that they would rather tell people total lies in order to get more money out of them than to stand by public service values. That has to be frightening.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things referred to in the interview was the cultural change that we've been through. There was a reference to a program in this, called Mammoth, about somebody coming forward from the 1970s with the attitudes of then and how ridiculous and out of place they are now. And I think what we are seeing is that there are cultural changes from generation to generation, and there will be more cultural changes. And this thing seems to be happening faster in America as well, with the consolidation of very right-wing and conservative attitudes, racist attitudes, imperialistic attitudes even, tied in with religious attitudes. And we have to think of a public service broadcaster which was part of the 1970s, did have Alf Garnett and all the rest of it, and in another 30 years will be living through another cultural change, perhaps even quicker than that. And so you need, within the BBC, you need something like the sense of, we are the intelligent people, we consolidate, we have the overview, we are dependable, and yet at the same time has to have that degree of fluidity, that it moves with the cultural change. Am I making a sensible point there?
There are powerful forces, though. And look, the Nolan Show has experienced this over the years, as you probably know, Maliki. There are powerful forces who seek to unilaterally define what is a reasonable way of talking. And I'll just give you examples, Gene. There are very, very powerful influencers in Northern Ireland and elsewhere in the UK, and they will describe some people who get very angry about the news when they're talking about it, and who shout or are very, very animated. They will describe those people as less intelligent than others. There are people who put value systems on people who call in to the BBC and other shows, and they describe those people as stupid, or we hear it with American coverage of Trump-esque. Well, why are people who support Trump any less intelligent than others? And that narrative very much permeates through some American news coverage. And the same happens here with millions and millions of people who often are working class and just want to speak a different way than others, who are automatically defined as intelligent or superior.
I don't think either Maliki or I have said that. I think that what we're asking for is a basis of common shared agreement about some facts in the world. That is much more difficult and puzzling.
Facts, absolutely. Facts.
To arrive at. But there is also, and one of the things that's wonderful about public service broadcasting is that it's also actually about, you know, values, frankly. It's about fun. It reaches us, it's about different moods. So it's also about our emotions. And one of the things that's very frightening about the modern world, I think, is that the mobs, Northern Ireland knows about, you know, what happens to people in groups online and over all sorts of things, get quite dangerous. And I completely think that we need to create a space in which we listen to each other. But you don't listen to people You don't listen to other people on Fox News. And there is really good evidence, really good empirical evidence tested, you know, in the kind of way that I can't do, but, you know, produced by universities that shows that public service broadcasting over the world produces, you know, more deliberative ways of arguing. Now,
there are bad ideas, in fact. I mean, there have been people on air saying things like, we should open fire on the small boats coming in. You know, there are bad ideas out there. There are ill thought out ideas. And there are people who are stupid or at least ill-informed and come up with nonsense that is destructive nonsense. And it does, without some degree of public service broadcasting or education, it does feed into the public discourse and it does change the way larger numbers of people think. You know, we see an evolution in thinking. There's one of the discussions is about the tendency of journalism towards being liberal, you know, and what are we going to do about that? But the reason that journalism becomes liberal is because reporters go out and they talk to people, they meet people within their own problems. I remember a time years ago, Stephen, when you decided that you were no longer going to use the word scumbag in relation to joyriders and delinquents.
Yeah.
You know, you'd come into the public arena like a shock jock, you know, and you were moderated by it. And we saw that moderation in you because you were interacting with people.
I think I grew problems. Up. I think I grew
yeah,
up.
Well, you grew up through journalism. You grew up through journalism. Journalism is a good thing. Journalism is something to be defended. You know,
okay.
And it isn't a problem that journalism tends towards liberal attitudes and liberal thinking, because journalism is an exploration of the world as it is.
I mean, if you don't call it liberal, you call it. I mean, of course, you know, it's flawed, and not all journalism's the same. But journalism is trying to establish what's going on in the world. It's an imperfect pursuer of verity. But without journalism, what we know. What had happened at Grenfell? What we know, in the end, what had happened to the postmasters? That those were journalists. They weren't who revealed those terrible, terrible scandals that one feels enormously guilty about, and not guilty enough probably. But without journalism, we wouldn't. They would have been uncovered. They would have gone on uncovered.
But are we prepared to pay for it?
Yeah, that's the question. Are we prepared to pay the price of not having it? Because what you get with that is social collapse. What you get with that is immature, childish politics.
I mean, there are ways of paying in all sorts of ways. And I would just say, I don't think some of the recent mistakes that have happened, say, around the Hamas documentary would have happened in Northern Ireland, because you live in a much more tense and scrupulous world where everything is very consequential. So there's a real, really interesting argument to be had about more devolution in the BBC, perhaps. But journalism informs, you know, the wonderful Kevin and Stacey are also related into our world,
okay.
And they come out of reality.
Jean, thank you very much. Really interesting conversation. Thank you, Malachy. Thanks, everyone. That's our week off to a start on The Nolan Show. We'll see you tomorrow morning when we start at 9 o'clock. Thanks, everyone. See you in the morning. Have a good day.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Show!